welcome everybody. You're supposed to clap or do something so we know it's beginning. Fred, join me, Mr. Mike Zeck. Now, I was figuring the best way for this to go is, since you guys are the fans, you guys have questions to ask, just put your hand up and we'll go through them one at a time and we'll try and get to everybody we can. Just be patient, all right? So put your hands up if you got a question.
Did everybody come to find out where I've been the last 10, 12 years or so? I figured that's why they'd come to the panel.
Well, where have you been?
I don't know, well, you're probably not aware that I've been doing licensing completely for at least the last 10 years. It's nothing in editorial. And why? Just kind of fell into it, I guess. But enjoying it. I'm doing a lot more digital stuff in licensing. And I kind of did my thing in editorial. I don't have this burning desire at the moment to go back to editorial stuff. I may go back and do a story or something, but I don't even have a specific plan at this point.
Could you elaborate on the differences between what licensing is and editorial is for those who aren't in on the industry terms, like myself?
Well, the biggest difference is I don't sign my work anymore. What I fell into was the DC licensing offices for the longest time, and doing a number of things. I mean, they kept me so busy, it was crazy, but Marvel didn't really do this at the time, but DC publishes what they call style guides. I don't know if you've ever seen a style guide or, but it's just a booklet of, depending, whatever character it is, it's Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, whichever one. It's a book of poses. They have some backgrounds. They have some other graphic treatments. They have some logo treatments for the character. But it's just like a complete style guide. And then when the licensees come to DC and say, well, we want Superman on our cards or party plates or a poster, whatever it might be, typically they give them the style guide and they choose from that. And by choosing, you know, if they want the background, they can go to backgrounds. It may be just a figure, it may be whatever. But every year, DC would publish style guides with new art for their main characters, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, whichever characters had animation shows on TV. And that over the years, that's been Crypto and Teen Titans, and so yeah, you've seen them probably on Cartoon Network or wherever.
Teletoon, by the way.
Yeah, so all of those would have a style, as long as they were on TV currently, they would have a style guide. And what they called their core characters were the ones, and then just style guides for everyone else. And everyone else that needed custom work, whether it be Mattel Toys, Fisher-Price, what have you, sometimes they would come and if they need art for their action figure toys, the boxes or the toy backs, then that would come through DC and I would be doing some of that as well. Go ahead. No,
I was just wondering, if somebody is an aspiring artist, is it possible for them to obtain something, one of these style guides, so that they could use the stuff that's outlined in that to help with their portfolio?
No, it was never like an on sale thing. These were just a very small print run, and it only went to licensees. They were never for the public, and that's why I figured most people here probably never saw a style guide ever show up anywhere. Probably, yeah. No, only went to licensees, and. You know, they weren't like turnarounds like you would give an artist. You know, sometimes if an artist is coming on a character, you give them a turnaround, as a reference point or something. But these style guides were nothing like that.
Well, what makes you want to get more into doing that and stop signing your work?
Well, and when I say that's the biggest difference, I mean, that doesn't matter to me. I mean, I understand that if it's out there on a card or on a cereal box or a soup can or whatever, you don't put your signature on it. And, so it had nothing to do with not signing it. It had more to do, well, there's like a natural, I think, desire to change anyway, styles. And but the biggest part of it to me was I was, through the 90s, I was getting into computer stuff, digital things, and they actually tapped me to do a lot of digital stuff in licensing, and I actually found that more challenging in some ways. Most people here use Photoshop, but you also know Adobe Illustrator, so you're aware of pixel-based in Photoshop, vector-based in Illustrator, and yeah, Illustrator was... I was basically doing the... Actually, in the style guides, they would give you they would do two versions. There would be like a fully rendered Batman in Photoshop, but then they'd also want the Illustrator version of it, so that... And those were just much... There was much more they could do with those, with, in terms of change. You could just change the color so easily. You know, because some clients had budget issues if they only needed four colors. Well, yeah, I was just layering everything for them. There was a base, the outline, the ink line drawing, black and white drawing, flat colors, and the shading on another and stuff. So easy just to go in there and just change it to suit the client. And truthfully, most people get friendly with Photoshop, but for some reason, a lot of people don't get that friendly with Illustrator. But I was more friendly with Illustrator in a way, and so they had... The fact that I could sit down and use Illustrator and the fact that I could draw as well. You know, you can find your computer jockeys, but it's hard to find one that can draw at the same time. So they took advantage of that. So even though I was penciling almost all my career, you know, prior to that, all of a sudden I was doing a whole lot more inking and coloring in with Illustrator.
Let's go way back. When you were a kid and you first see your first comic, like, was there a moment or a specific story or picture or image that made you go, I want to be a visual artist? Like, what is it that really, was there one moment?
No, there's like a thousand moments, I'm sure. Yeah, and because I'm one of those unusual people that I don't have a memory that where comic books weren't like part of my life. And I'm not sure if I was 3 or 4 years old, laying in a hospital bed, having my tonsils taken out. But I actually remember the crib-style bed, and it was full of comics. And I couldn't read comics at the time, but it was full of them. It was full of Roy Rogers, Dale Evans, and the Hopalong Cassidy comics, that kind of thing. Not sure why they were there, but I actually have that visual memory of those comics being there. Any other memory I have, even from then on, my dad taking me to the barber shop, I wanted to go because I knew there would be a stack of comics in the waiting area. So, and even in high school, or not high school, I mean elementary school, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. It was just that rare thing. It wasn't be a policeman or a fireman or any of that stuff. I wanted to draw comics. And my teachers knew it. Everyone knew it. You know, and I was just sitting around at home. I was tracing comics or trying to copy them. And even in school, I just sat in the back of the class. And, you know, big mistake in a way. And that's how I went through school. Just went single-minded. Just wanted to do comics. Not worried about academics at all. And went to... art school, right after high school, with that specific thing in mind. I only want to draw comics. And once I got into comics, and people started coming up to me at conventions and things too, I said, look, don't ever do what I did. You know, don't ever put all your eggs in one basket, you know, and do nothing. But go to, because comics is a fairly closed field. It's not that easy to break in. You know, if I hadn't broken into comics, I'd be truck driving or something. You know, I have no idea what I'd be doing. So I was very lucky, you know, to to be single-minded and attain what I wanted to accomplish anyway.
How did your family, friends, and teachers treat your comic desires?
Well, my parents weren't supportive. You know, they didn't want to have an artist as a child. You know, they still had that picture of the starving artist. And I can kind of tell you the teachers along the way that helped me. But my third grade teacher, she called my parents in because I was sitting in the back of the class and just kind of doing nothing, yeah, not paying attention to the class at all. And she wasn't really sure why, but I was like back there sketching, things like that, you know, which she wasn't aware of. And but she was wondering why I wasn't getting involved, I guess, in the class. And she would test me. I was lucky because school came a little bit easy to me anyway, but everybody had their hands up to answer a question. I didn't, but she'd call on me anyway. Then I'd give her the answer. I knew the answer anyway. Then I'd go back to what I was doing and stuff. But she actually called my parents in and say, what's he interested in? You know, why is he sitting back there not involved? And of course, my parents were like, oh, all he wants to ever do, you know, is sit around drawing comics, and, you know, he knows it, all these artists, and, you know, like, they just thought it was the worst thing in the world. And but that teacher in third grade, she came back to me after that meeting, well, in class. And it turned out that she even had some art classes. She was something of an artist. And she sat down with me, you know, instead of trying to change me or anything, she sat down with me, and she was the first person ever. I'd never seen an art instruction book, never taken an art class. She drew an oval and showed me how to construct the head with using guidelines, and I'd never seen that before, you know, but she took the time to do that with me, knowing that I was interested in art. And I spent like months after that just drawing heads, and I was so much better knowing, you know, how to do the structure and stuff. Big, you know, and I'll never forget her, you know, for doing that.
Are there still some books that you picked up along the way that really changed the way you started drawing and refined your style? Or well, helped you find it, I guess.
Are you meaning in comic books or art instruction?
Just art books or anything like that.
My style was, and again, being so single-minded with comics, I think at least I see it. I think we all see our style a little differently than a reader or the viewer sees it. But I just see my style as a combination of all those artists, which is hundreds, you know, just about everybody I liked coming through the ages. I just see it as a sort of an amalgam of the all of those styles. You know, I don't think I see my style as being so original, even though I understand it is. You know, people can pick out my style on a book as easy as I could pick out Gil Kane or Steve Ditko or anyone else, but you know, it's just hard for me to see it that way. But in terms of the influence, I didn't really study art books very much. In art school, they would throw Andrew Loomis and some of those books, which were great. You know, but my bigger influences, I think, were the actual comics.
Now, we had a sketch show a few minutes ago, and one guy was just in art school like 10 years ago, and he was saying that in art school, they treated comics as like this backwater netherworld where real artists don't do that. Did you have experiences like that when you were in art school?
I was lucky. I don't know. Well, probably from around here, you don't know it. In Florida, there's an art school. It's called Ringling School of Art. And it's actually connected with the brothers, Ringling Brothers, who started the circus. John Ringling, one of the brothers, was an immense art collector. I mean, these giant paintings and things from Europe, you know, truly good art collection. He started the museum in Sarasota, Florida, and then just as a logical extension, he started the art school. And at that time, this was the late 60s when I graduated, and that was still a private school, but it was considered one of the best, surely the best art school in the southeastern U.S., and if not, yeah, it's probably one of the top 10, I would think. Very well respected, but that's where I went. And at that time, in the 60s. I mean, comics were popular because the Marvel comics had started early 60s. But there was not smallish school, but there was still not one person in there that wanted to do comics other than me. But the lucky thing was is that my figure teacher, who had just started that same year, he was a comics fan. So there was my connection. Yeah, I had my connection with a teacher rather than the other students. It was him I huddled with and talked, Frank Frazetta and Hogarth and all the people that the other students had no idea, you know, who we were talking about, but Harry Havlitz did.
So how did you get that initial break into the comic book world? Like you mentioned, it's really insular and close-knit. Like, how did you get your foot in the door?
Well, yeah, I wish I had all the tools that everybody has now. You know, I was in Florida at that time, and back in that day, you know, without internet, without anything, you know, today you can just email your favorite artist or come to these conventions, you know, that easily and see people. I didn't know of a single professional who was in South Florida at that time, and there may not have been. You know, if there was, I didn't know about them. So it was just me, and of course there weren't all these. Now there are so many small press publishers. You can self-publish. You know, I could have done that. You know, at the time, but then it was either Marvel or DC or Charlton Comics, and other than that, it really, you weren't going to be able to do anything. It would have been Archie or Harvey or some of the more animated style things. So there wasn't much to do but put together some drawings and mail them to New York to these publishers, and that's what I did. That's what I did in the early 70s, and got my first, you know, usual rejections first time around.
They actually sent you a rejection letter.
Yeah.
So how many times did you send stuff in? And were you applying to just
once.
Marvel? Or?
Well, Marvel, DC, Charlton.
Yeah.
I tried. Those were the three. Really, that was the only three that were viable for my style, I guess. I only sent once, and then I decided I was going to go to the New York conventions that Phil Suling was hosting. In the early 70s, and if you go, you know, there weren't so many back then either, but being in New York, that was like the San Diego now. Yeah, that was the biggest show in the 70s, and being in New York, then the publishers did show up there. You always knew you would see editors from all the companies, as well as a ton of professionals who all lived in the New York area. So that's what I did. I went up there in 71. When I went in 71, that was more of a fan venture, I think. And then I went up a few years later with my portfolio in mind. And that was the key, you know, just to be there in person and have them look at it, talk to them. There was interest. There wasn't, like, a ton of work at the time, so they didn't give me anything right away, but within a few months, I had a call from Charlton and said, hey, let's try. It was only like little illustrations for the animated books. They had text stories. I did a few of those, and then I just went right into the horror comics. And Charlton was really a good learning experience, I think. Unlike Marvel and DC, they were just very loose. They would send you a script and... You know, Marvel DC, the norm is do the pencils, then those would get edited, and then come the inks, then come the colors. Well, Charlton would send you a script, and they would want you to pencil, ink it, and letter it, and just send it back to them print ready, just ready to go. So I wasn't a letterer, and I wasn't even an inker. You know, I didn't consider myself an inker, so that stuff, when I look back at it, you know, I think it's god-awful, but at the same time, that's like somebody throwing you into the deep end of the pool, you know, learn or die, I guess. And so good experience for those couple years at Charlton.
Now, when you had to do your own lettering, did you draw like the first few panels and then all of a sudden you realize, I'm going to put a talk bubble here and there's a face?
Well, no, I think I knew enough at the time, and Charlton even had some tiny little book that was like a how to draw comics or something. And The fortunate thing, because I would have never known, but there was something called an Ames lettering guide. It was just like a little plastic thing with holes in it that you would put a T-square up, put this guide on it, put your pencil point through the hole, and then slide it across, and that's how you get your lines. Yeah, and because the spacing of the holes, the way you turned it, you would get it so that it would be the height of the lettering that you wanted, plus the next one would be the space between the lettering and stuff. So thanks to a book, I knew how to do that. And so that was it. Yeah, that's the way everybody hand lettered anyway. That Ames lettering guide was sort of the default little tool for all those guys that hand lettered comics.
So how did you step from there into doing like superhero stuff like Marvel and DC?
Well, I kind of always wanted, I was the big Marvel fan anyway, and that's where I wanted to end up. And I'd say 74-ish, I think it was. Well, I think the first little break was I was working, South Florida had a fanzine called RBCC. I don't know if anybody's ever, you remember that. Jim Van Hise, Gordon Love at the time were publishing it. And they also put on little, very small conventions in South Florida. I started going to those, and they started to discover that I could draw. And so then anything that I drew, they were willing to publish in RBCC. And so that was kind of my fan art outlet, I guess. And that RBCC magazine was really well respected among fandom, and a lot of the professionals subscribed to it too. Roy Thomas, he subscribed to it, and he saw my Conan cover, Conan the Barbarian, and he said, "Yeah, I'd like to use that in the magazine, their black and white magazine at Marvel." And great. Yeah. So that was really my first sale, just somebody picking up on the RBCC, and that led to a few more of the black and white illustrations for the magazine line. And around that same time, even Stan Lee had come down to Miami for a convention on the beach, and he came
literally
in.
Literally on the beach?
Yeah, right. Miami Beach. Yeah. I'm trying to think. I think it was the Americana Hotel on North Miami Beach, but he came in, and I had my Charlton stuff out there, and Stan was great. The first time I'd ever met him, and I wasn't really working at Marvel at the time. And I had done a bunch of art for the convention, put up on the walls. I'd done, like, and for the program book and stuff. It was the Silver Surfer, the Hulk, and I'm trying to think of the third character. Oh, so it must have been Submariner, because I had them all, like, running like they were on Miami Beach with floats, things, or, you know, like surfing shorts and things like that. That was up on the walls, and Stan saw my Charlton story that I had on display. He thought it was great. And when I told him I did the thing on the wall, you know, with the Marvel characters and stuff, he said, "Man," he said, "I thought Marie Severin did that, you know, it was like a humor thing." I said, "No, I did it." And to his credit, he got on the phone and Marv Wolfman was the editor-in-chief and I'm trying to, it was either 74 or 75, I think maybe 74. And he was only editor-in-chief for a very short while, but Stan said, "Hey, you know, you gotta give this guy some work." And good for him, but Marv wasn't that impressed, I guess. So he never like gave me the work. And even when I tried to get it more into the black and white business, I think it was Ralph Macchio that was editor that year, and he wasn't impressed. But like I said, Marv Wolfman was very short-lived at that position, and then Archie Goodwin came in for his short tenure, and Archie liked my stuff, so all of a sudden I was in. You know, I got a little color tryout, and then Archie just started giving me, kind of unfortunately, I guess, but they didn't have a book open. But what if somebody was so late and they really needed to fill in, or somebody to do something really fast to catch up, which is really a tough thing to give a guy, you know, who's still trying to learn, but I was in no position to say no, so I took them, and you know, Archie was glad that I did, and that was it. You know, from then on, I just had all the Marvel work I wanted.
So, what was the first character that you were drawing from Marvel that you were really jacked about because this was a character you really loved?
Well, what Archie was giving me was, in the beginning, was the Master of Kung Fu, and trying to think, his name's escaping me now, the guy who was regular on the book at that time. It wasn't Paul Gillespie, because Paul Gillespie had gotten off the book. I do remember he was Canadian. No, not Gene Day. I actually brought Gene in later on the book. I don't know why his name's escaping me now, but he was just couldn't do the monthly thing. And so I started the first thing Archie gave me, he needed an entire book penciled in a week. And that was just like crazy. You know, I've never penciled a book in a week, and I never did since, but I did sit down and pencil a book in a week, as god-awful as it was. And they did get their deadline. And Archie kind of worked it into where, okay, then he would give me a fill-in issue, knowing that this guy would be late anyway, and you know, and at that point, they would have one to throw in. And it just, after a number of months, a guy was late enough that they had to invite him off the book. And then I was just the next logical candidate since I'd been doing the fill-in. So, but that, I mean, I liked the character. I liked Doug Mensch, the writer. I thought he was a very good writer. And, you know, Shang-Chi, Master Kung Fu, to me, he was Bruce Lee. I was a big Bruce Lee fan, so I was very happy to do the book.
Two questions, I guess. Mm-hmm. One is, out of all the characters you've worked on, I guess, who is your favorite character to work on? And the second question is, at any point while working on Kraven the Last Stand, did you realize the impact it was going to have, I guess, on Spider-Man, you know, Marvel Comics, you know, in general?
Yeah. Well, in terms of characters, if you're talking like specifically characters, I was always a Captain America fan, and, you know, I think I was lobbying for that book even after a few years of Kung Fu stuff. You know, I was kind of waiting for an opening on Captain America. And probably still, I mean, I love that character. I really like to draw him. And even when I sit around just doing something for myself, even today, you know, probably going to be Captain America. I just like the character. You mentioned Kraven, though, and that's surely one of the favorite series, you know, I've ever done. And when you say the impact, I mean, I'm really glad that everybody liked it that much. When I got the plot from DeMatteis, J.M. DeMatteis for that, I mean, I knew right away that was like the best, I'll call it the best Spider-Man story, you know, that I ever read. But the way he defined Kraven, you know, Kraven had been around since the 60s, but no one ever did that much with him. He was just kind of like a throwaway character. And DeMatteis just took that character and went with his Russian descent and just went, you know, just created this wonderful character, I thought. Totally defined him just in that series. So he was never defined in the how many years prior, at least 20 years prior, I guess. And he defined him in that series. And that part of it, and even the Peter Parker, Mary Jane part of it, yeah, everything that was going on in there, I just thought, you know, I knew it was the best story I ever read, just reading the plot. I didn't know what readers would think, but, you know, I understood it was probably the best Spider-Man story, you know, probably to date. And I just felt lucky, you know, to be the guy, you know, to draw that one.
Now, the subject matter in that book, it's pretty heavy, like with sexual assault and things like that. Now, when you were starting working in comics, did you ever foresee, like, mainstream comics touching on subject matter like that so directly?
No, I'd say no. I didn't really foresee that sort of gradual change to more adult stuff, more dark stories and things. Maybe I should have seen it. You know, because I think after, it was Marvel that really changed that. You know, prior to Marvel, all comics were aimed at 12, 13 years old readers. Marvel, when Stan Lee started the Marvel Age in the 60s, suddenly it was cool to be in high school and college and still read comics. And Stan's stories, I think they were a little more adult in nature, but like nothing dark. You know, it was just, they were just, you know, something that an older reader could get behind. But it's funny the progression through the decades, you know, how, and a lot of people are doing it because they're copying Stan, you know, because every once in a while, you know, realistic things have, people are going to get married, you know, it's in the Marvel Age, they're going to break up, somebody might die, but I do remember consciously thinking that things are happening like too fast now. That it seems like the people that, the writers that were coming in that wanted to copy Stan, I don't know how many people have gone back and read the old stuff. You know, I was fortunate enough that as a fan, you know, I was at an age right at the beginning of the Marvel Age, so I read everything from issue one forward, had the collection for a while too, which I should have kept. But they're, even in the Ditko issues of Spider-Man, the first 3 years worth or so of it, yeah, there were things happening, but I remember that Aunt May wanted to introduce Peter to this, what she thought was a nice girl, and that thing just like dragged on for almost a year's worth of issues before we even got to see Mary Jane. And then even that, you know, then that would drag on for a while, but compared to that, you know, 20 years later, in the same issue, you could meet someone, fall in love, and then they're dead. You know, they're dead at the end of the issue. And Stan would have never done that. You know, that would never happen in the earlier years. So, yeah, I mean, I'm it's okay with me. You know, I kind of, I was growing along with them, and I was at a mature age anyway, so if comics got mature and dark, I was fine with it, but you know, I don't think those were that appropriate for 12 and 13-year-olds. I talked to a few people today at the table who their first comic, because they saw Spider-Man clawing his way out of a grave, you know, that was there. And they're 12, and that's their first comic. And I said, you really like that one at 12 years old, you know, the Kraven story? Yeah. I'm good. You know, maybe they're more mature now, 12 years old, than I was.
Mike, you seem like a guy that started off as a fan, and then, you know, you made good on that promise to be an artist, be a comic artist, and you know, to have a lot of enthusiasm for the medium, and then to work in it. Has it changed the way you look at the stories you grew up, and, you know, like, people like the story, like the Spider-Man story, and like, oh, this is awesome, and then, you know, to you, that's like Bible, and you're working in the medium that creates these stories. Do you feel like that enthusiasm has changed? Do you still appreciate it in terms of stories, and as a whole special place in your heart, or is it more like, you know, this is just another day at work, and now that you need to license stuff, like, did you change now coming from a fan to a creator, or is it all the same thing to you?
Well, I think I know what you mean, and I think, yeah, my career sort of went in the decades. The 70s was sort of my break-in period, basically, and getting solid and with Marvel, and surely I was still the biggest fan through the 80s, still the biggest fan in the 90s. I still a fan, still had a certain motivation, but what I wanted to do in the 90s was sort of develop my style, you know, do a little change up, which is a natural thing, I think, but that never, well, that and by that time I was experimenting even with some of the other publishers, even some of the smaller press publishers. I don't even know if anybody here saw the Malibu series in the early 90s called The Eliminator that I did. Anyone? One? Yeah. Yeah. Basically an unseen thing, but like that particular book, you know, I put a lot of work into that, a lot, and that was, I sort of had like that the Malibu Ultraverse was kind of a creator-owned universe in a way, too. And so with Roland Mann, Hank Canals, they wrote the series. And me, we came up with the whole thing. I spent a lot of time doing the preliminary work for the characters and their surroundings and everything. And put a lot of work into the books. I thought, you know, I thought that was one of my better series in a way. But being a Malibu book, and I guess being outside of the big two, it was went largely unseen. And another creator-owned thing was the series Damned for Image for their creator-owned line. And I don't know how many people saw that either, but it didn't sell very well. And I really tried to do something of a more European style, which I was influenced by, you know, on that book, and even got, I don't know if you know Denis Rodier, he's in Montreal, inker, and that's his influences too, so we had a very good time doing the book, and but again, largely unseen, and I don't know if that affected my overall enthusiasm, or whether after so many years, you know, it was starting to drop a little bit, possibly. But, you know, I think the transition to licensing was kind of a good transition for me anyway. I'd kind of done what I wanted to do in comics, and I've always said, and I know some other people say this too, it's a young man's game. You really have to be super motivated. You have to be willing to stay up all night from time to time, you know, if you want to get your monthly comic book in. And I wasn't doing so much of that anymore, and I did have the interest in digital at the time, and so it just seemed natural. I mean, I did licensing because that was interesting to me. It was challenging, and I didn't really miss doing the continuity at the time, and I still don't, really. Truthfully, I don't. It's kind of one of those things, you've been there, done that, and move on, I guess. I think there's a little bit of a natural, finite, I think, period of time when you're doing your best comics work, maybe, anyway, or you're really inspired and motivated comics work, I think. Is anybody here caught up online with that... Jerry Ordway did a blog about ageism, and it went a little viral about the older guys in comics. He's younger than me, but he's still an older guy in comics. It's been this way forever, but because when I was coming in, there were the people like Kurt Swan and Gil Kane and people like that, and they were kind of being phased out. You know, they were still at a period where they wanted to work. They weren't retired, but styles change. What styles are popular changes, and that's a big part of what Jerry's blog is about. That he's not retired and he's still very viable, but the work isn't coming like it used to from DC and things. And you know, I kind of get it, and I guess. You know, I sort of did instead of being a Kurt Swan or a Jerry or something, you know, who just stayed in that same place and expected plots to come in every month and forever, I just kind of moved around and moved in different directions and things. And I do feel that way, you know, that I don't think I could give the same effort to... a story right now that I did in the 80s, maybe. You know, I don't think it would be exactly the same. And, you know, I take my hat off to the new guys, too. I mean, I'm in awe of some of the people that are doing comics now. You know, I had all my inspirations growing up, and, you know, and then the best thing you can hope to do is come in, try to raise the bar a little bit, you know, which I felt like I did in certain areas, but these guys coming after me who are doing comics now, they're raising the bar. You know, they're raising the bar higher than I did. So good for them. You know, it's their time. You know, they're young. They're inspired. They're strong, motivated, good. You know, it's their time. Me, Garcia Lopez, people like that, we move on to licensing and or do other things, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Zach, thank you very much for coming by. I've got like 4 or 5 questions that I want to ask, but I'm not allowed. I'm getting the head shake right there.
We killed an hour.
Yeah. Thank you very much, everybody. Yeah.